The Turning Point with Mike Feder is about to be broadcast, and it's your choice. You understand? It's your choice, and you have to take the responsibility if you want to listen to it. So here I am, and I'm glad I am here at PRN.FM because my other show on Sirius XM may not last very long. So the other night, was it Saturday? I had to do my show on Saturday night on Sirius XM, and I committed one of the three major gaffes that you're not supposed to ever commit on commercial radio. One is, so if you don't know, I'll let you know. One is, you don't criticize the management on commercial radio out loud on the radio. You don't do that. Unless you are Howard Stern and get like $85 million a year and they want to keep you, you could say what you like. So you don't criticize the management. You don't say nothing on the, you don't do this on the radio, on commercial radio. Never. This is what you don't do. See what I'm saying? You don't do that. And the third thing you don't do is screw with the commercials. You don't mess up the commercials. So the other night I'm talking with them. Now, I spent 25 years in at BAI, non-commercial radio, right? And I've been at Sirius for 10 years now. But I have never really gotten out of the habit of being on non-commercial radio. So I have one break that's up to me to decide when I take this commercial break. It's 3 minutes long during one of my, you know, I have a three-hour show on Sirius, and each hour, at the end of the hour, there's a bunch of commercials. But during the show, there's one commercial break, and I can take it whenever I want. But since I'm so used to talking at length about anything I want from BAI for 25 years, even when I'm interviewing a guest, I'll have a conversation and I'll forget to take a break. And so the engineer's job, you know, at a commercial radio station is to tell you when a break is coming up. You know, a break is due at a certain time if you have scheduled breaks, or that you are that you haven't taken your break. You know, and what they do is they there's all kinds of signals that engineers do if they are, you know, if they're in another room, what they'll do is, you know, if you're in a separate studio from them behind some glass, they'll say something into your headphones maybe. But if you're in the same room with them, and I like to work in the same room with the engineer, what they'll do is they'll do hand signals. And there's hand signals for any kind of profession, right? You know, like the cops, combat, you know, football, whatever, hand signals. One of the hand signals for an engineer is they put their hands together as if they were, you know, their hands in front of them, like, and they make fists. It's like they were holding a bar or a stick. And then they snap it, make a snapping. So that means break, take a break, right? Something breaking. So, you know, between, I don't know, being distracted and me going on and on and on, I won't say droning on, never. I was so fascinating, probably. Anyhow, we both got preoccupied, and I didn't really take the break on time. And what happened was all kinds of complications. So I'm very happy to be here, and I hope that people are listening to this show. Because who knows what will happen over there. Anyhow, I'll find out this week. Let's see. So here's the situation. The other day I'm walking around, and I'm not happy it's fall. I am never happy that it's fall. I don't like the fall. I mean, some people love different seasons. I don't like the fall. It's colder. It's darker. And, of course, one of the most visible symbols, if not the most visible symbol of them all, is that the leaves leave the trees. Now, I understand. I was listening to Thich Nhat Hanh, you know, the incredible, beautiful Buddhist monk, priest, in one of his lectures, and he specifically mentioned this about sitting in a park or in a wood in some place that he was. And it was during the fall, and he watched a leaf, he said, detach itself, which is a beautiful way of putting it, detach itself. The wind blew it off from a tree, you know, and it fell down. It was a yellowish-red leaf, and it was on its way out. And the leaf fell at his feet. And he looked at the leaf, and he said, the leaf is not unhappy that it, you know, dried up and died and fell off the tree and will now become, you know, dust and mold into the earth. The leaf doesn't feel that way. The leaf knows that it had its birth, it had its spring, it had its life, it made its contribution, and now it's time to move to another place. And, you know, I'm just only paraphrasing it, and I'm not speaking the way he does. It's absolutely a beautiful description. But, you know, I don't think I'm the only one who feels this way. You walk around, and the trees, all the beautiful trees, which are incredible green, right? And if you live in a city, it's even more important. When you go up to a park, you need the park like somebody in a desert needs water, right? You need that green because the city is all concrete and glass and steel and bricks and asphalt, and it's disgusting. And, you know, whatever you take in your five senses is how you feel inside. It's what you become almost, right? It's how you can feel. So the life of a city, obviously, is very inside and internal. And you go outside, generally speaking, to go somewhere or maybe to buy something. But you don't just stand outside on the sidewalk like you would stand in the woods and look around and listen and feel and see things, right? You don't do that in the city so much. Unless, of course, you take a lot of pictures like I do these days. So, you know, the leaves, the green leaves are absolutely something desperately needed for people who live in the city and want to get a break for their eyes, how it smells, you know, the sound of the leaves, everything, your senses, right? So it's really depressing in the city when it gets cold, it gets gray, it gets to be November, October, November, and then even early December if a few leaves are left on. But the leaves go from being green, then turning various colors, and then all fall off. And what you're looking at is these bare, black trees. and they look like, depending on the level of your paranoia and imagination, they look like something out of a very nasty cartoon, like a bad old Disney cartoon, you know. The branches are reaching up, and they're black, and they look like long fingers and hands. But essentially, basically, what you're looking at is our trees that are black and, you know, gray, dark gray and black, and empty, bare. They don't have the leaves on them anymore. And to me, it's a very depressing thing, and that's what's happening these days. But there's a certain point, right, you know, right before it happens, when it's there's this beauty, this absolute glorious beauty, which everybody's familiar with, when the leaves turn, and when they turn yellow and gold, and depending on where you live. In New York City, the leaves turn yellow, maybe a little gold, then they turn tannish brown, then they fall off the leaf, then fall off the tree. That's it. There's hardly any red or orange, those beautiful red-orange colors. You don't get too much of that in the city. Might have something to do with the air, you know, with all the exhaust fumes and all the building, you know, all the stuff that comes out of the building smokestacks. I don't really know. But the leaves don't turn red, or maybe it's the kind of trees, but the leaves don't turn that red, reddish orange, which makes them so beautiful sometimes in the woods. But the most beautiful color in New York City on a tree that you can get in a park is kind of a golden color, not just yellow, but almost kind of a bright yellow, slightly golden color. And there's a tree right across from my building in a little pocket park, a little tiny park. And I came out the other day to look at it. I didn't have my camera with me, and I was too lazy to go back upstairs and get it because I was going someplace, and I was, you know, I had to be in a hurry. But right across from me was this beautiful sort of mid-sized tree. I don't know, maybe 40 feet high, 35, 40 feet high. And completely dressed out, covered, all of its leaves. None had fallen off yet, or very few. And it was completely golden yellow. Absolutely beautiful, right? And later on that night, when I was lying in bed, not able to shut my mind off as usual, I started thinking all of a sudden of the Robert Frost poem, you know, The Road Not Taken. But the way I thought about it was The Road Not Traveled, which I was getting confused, obviously, with a further line in the poem, and then even more with that book. Was it by M. Scott Peck? Is that his name? The book that sold 200 million copies and was translated into Urdu and Martian and everything else. It was on the New York Times bestseller list since I was 12 until I was 65 or something. M. Scott Peck, The Road Less Traveled. And which I never read, by the way. This guy was a psychologist or a psychiatrist and wrote about, I guess he wrote about choices that you make, or, you know, doing something that's difficult, or doing something that's maybe against the grain of society or what your parents want. I suppose that was the theme of the book. And I'm sure it was a good book. You know, sometimes pop psychology books can be as profound or as worthwhile as any kind of great work of philosophy or psychology or religion, you know. Anyhow, I kept thinking of it as A Road Less Traveled. But in fact, the name of the poem, which I just found out, just checking on the computer, is The Road Not Taken by Robert Frost. And you must know that poem. You probably told you about it. They probably showed it in school, right? Like when you're in high school, they tell you all the Robert Frost poems in high school, or they used to. Is Robert Frost still taught? I have no idea. My kids are way old now. They're 28 and 33, my children. So there's no, I don't know anything about what goes on in schools anymore. And I don't know any little kids to talk to about what they teach in school. I think all I ever see kids doing is playing video games and messing around with smartphones. So I don't know what they learn in school. But do they teach poetry in school at all? Maybe they do, maybe they don't. What about in the green room? Did you learn poetry in school? What about you, Mr. Engineer? Did they teach you any poetry in school? No. See? But that's the school you went to. You went to military school, right? So I don't know. Anyhow, they don't teach poetry in school. Maybe, I don't know. Maybe they do teach poetry in school. But they used to teach us poetry. And Robert Frost was one of the, and he is. Did you ever read Robert Frost? Robert Frost has that incredibly deceptive simplicity, which is part of the genius of Robert Frost's poems. He'll write about the most bleak, complex human relationships, about death, about everything that's profound in society and culture, about morals, about death, about sex, life, relationships, marriage, whatever, and illness. But in that kind of way that almost seems like a child wrote it, which is his great genius, or part of his great genius. And I love Robert Frost's poems. I guess maybe also I was thinking about Robert Frost. You know how it is sometimes things occur to you, but you don't know why unless you start to examine them? Another reason I was thinking about Robert Frost in the midst of all this with the yellow tree. Let me say, the reason I was thinking of the Road Not Taken was because the first line of that poem, which I thought was The Road Less Traveled By, but the first line of Robert Frost's poem, The Road Not Taken, is two roads diverged in a yellow wood. Beautiful way to start a poem, right? It's picturesque, and right away he states the case, right? Two roads diverged in a yellow wood. Beautiful, absolutely beautiful. And I was thinking of that because the tree was yellow, right? And the other reason I was thinking of Robert Frost is because it, in a few days, not too long from now, it will be the 50th anniversary of the assassination of John Kennedy. And I was 18 years old when that happened. If you talk to people who were in my father's generation, and there's not that many of them around, you know, they're dying off now, and now it's all us baby boomers or the old folks. But in my father's generation, they could all remember, and you know, including my grandmother's generation, they could all remember exactly where they were and what they were doing the day that Franklin Roosevelt died, because it was so important and staggering, and he was such a monumental figure that had changed everything and taken them through a war and saved them from the Depression. So everybody remembers from back in that generation just what they were doing, where they were, and how they felt when they heard that Roosevelt died. Now, Roosevelt had been sick for a long time, although people covered it up. It was clear that he was sick. If you saw pictures of him, the last few pictures of him taken wherever, and especially at, I think it was the Yalta Conference, whatever the last conference he had with Churchill and Stalin. I mean, he looked really, really ill. And people knew he was sick. There were rumors leaking out. And when he died, it was a shock to people just because they didn't want it to happen. Roosevelt had saved the country from the Depression. Of course, it's much more complicated than that, but to a lot of people, he had saved the country from the Depression. He had instituted and campaigned for in the most astounding way. If you ever saw him talk, you know what I'm talking about. There's never been a president with the kind of charisma and the kind of moral persuasion and use of his voice, maybe in American history, than Franklin Roosevelt. Nobody has ever matched Franklin Roosevelt. I've never heard Lincoln, obviously, but I don't know. In any case, he was the father of the country. He led people out of dire poverty. Millions of people starving, no place to live, no jobs. Children, you know, living on nothing with no heat. People dying of disease because everybody was so poor. And he led the country out of this dire situation, this horrible misery. Then through World War II, was triumphant, but died before the war ended. And people all remember him, and they were shocked and overwhelmed with grief when he died. Something more minor, but somewhat similar happened when Kennedy died for my generation. I was 18 years old. It was on a Friday, and it happened, I think, in the middle of the day sometime, somewhere around 11:30 noon, 12:30, 1, something like that. And he was in Dallas and got shot. And I was cleaning my car. In my neighborhood, everybody had a used car. If you had a new car, everybody would look at you very funny and expect you to certainly be moving soon. In my neighborhood, we had these little tiny houses with little tiny postage stamps, yards, and we all had a used car. If you wanted to get a car, you got a used car. And mine was about 3 years old. It was a Studebaker Lark. A Studebaker Lark. Studebaker doesn't exist anymore. It was big in the, I don't know, 20s through 50s. And disappeared, I think, in the 60s, maybe. But I had, and they made a car called the Studebaker Lark. You understand, the Lark, right? To name a car the Lark was already perverse and bizarre, because in the 60s, this car I bought was made in 1960, And I bought it in 1962. This car was only a year old for me, but it was a three-year-old car. And it had all kinds of troubles, but it was a cool little car. It was a little compact car, a little tiny car. Not like a Volkswagen, but a small car. Kind of squarish looking, but it was a convertible. My first car was a convertible, right? I probably got a lot of girls, right, from doing this. Is that politically incorrect? It was cool. And it had red leather seats. Somebody had taken out the regular seats in this car, which was actually, Studebakers were very dull, square cars, at least when I was a kid. And it was not a jazzy car at all. And somebody in this car had, not only had they taken out the regular seats and put in red leather seats, which by the time I got it were sort of cracked, but still it was cool to have red leather seats. But they had already, they also had taken out the engine. Whoever had this car had taken out the little tiny Lark engine, you know, with the little tiny bird engine that it had, and put in some gigantic Pontiac or Cadillac engine in this little tiny car. The engine was about half the size of the car. So it was this weirdo little car that it looked like a little old lady car. And when I was driving it, but if I was to touch the gas pedal, just tap it, the front part would go up and the back go down like a boat in the water, like a power boat. it would go 0 to 60 in about 1 second. It was like a rocket ship. Of course, it wore out every other part in the car because, you know, it was like putting an elephant's heart in a person in a human's body, right? It just wore everything else out, right? But this is my bizarre little car, and I love this car because it was the first thing I ever got of substance, and a car was everything. You know, I was 18, right? And I bought my first car, and I lived out on Long Island where people drove all over the place. It wasn't like I lived in the city, and I wasn't a subway bus kid. You know, it was still cars out where I lived. And it was a big thing. To get a car, that was it. I mean, you know, first it was a bicycle, and you grow up and you get a car. And I had a used car, and I spent... How much did it cost? It cost It cost $900. This is in 1962. It cost $900 as a used car. And it was all my money. It was money that I had saved up for years. Since I was about 12 years old, I had saved all this money. And since I never spent money on anything, it was still sitting there from innumerable snow shoveling jobs, weeding, grass cutting, chores, babysitting, a million things I did that I got paid, and I had several hundred dollars, and I think my father threw in $150 or $200 to help me get over the top and buy this car. Anyhow, I love my car, and I'm cleaning my car. It's in the driveway. It was November 22nd. It was a Friday. And I guess I didn't have school or decided not to go to school that day. I was in college. I was a sophomore in college. And I'm cleaning the car. I clean the outside. I clean the inside. I was vacuuming it. And to keep myself entertained, I had the radio on to ABC, which was, you know, the latest rock and roll. Dan Ingram, Cousin Brucey, all these people. And they were playing all the latest rock and roll, which was, this is 1963. So the rock and roll was not yet sex, drugs, and rock and roll. It was late 50s sort of turning into something else, you know. And that was the point of it all, of course, is that essentially, and I'm going to talk about this at length probably next week because the anniversary is coming up, the 50s lasted until the day that Kennedy got shot. Up until the very minute that John F. Kennedy got shot, it was the 50s. With all its repression and suppression and grayness and squareness and prudishness and following orderness. And then he got shot, and we all believed in him. We didn't know much about him, and the paper didn't reveal all of his affairs. We didn't pay attention. But the thing about Kennedy was that he was youthful. He wasn't the same old grandpa like Eisenhower with the gray hat and the gray suit. Like all these guys, every man had a gray suit or a gray hat or looked gray or was very grown up. They all looked like they were 100 years old. All of a sudden comes this red-haired, youthful guy. He's charming. He's witty. He smiles. He engages with people. And he had all kinds of ideas that seemed to include young people. And he deliberately did it to get young people's votes. And, you know, it was extraordinary. He was also the first television president. And that's why he won, really, because he debated poor old gloomy Gus Richard Nixon, who was sweating and had a 5 o'clock shadow and was part of the old generation. Anyhow, Kennedy was our hero. I had worked for his election a couple of years before, and he was a big hero to young people. When we found out more about him and what he was doing, it got more complicated. But then he was a big hero. I was 18. I needed a hero. He was my hero. And he got shot. It was staggering. And I remember where I was, you know, everything. But the reason I'm talking about Kennedy here is because, connected to what I was talking about before, the Yellow Tree, Robert Frost poem. One thing that Kennedy did, which seemed to be sort of revolutionary, that impressed a lot of us too, was that he picked Robert Frost, who was by that time a very old man, maybe in his late 70s or maybe 80s for all I know. He picked Robert Frost to deliver, I don't know if anybody had ever picked a poet before. Maybe, maybe not. If they did, it was some sort of old-fashioned poet. But he picked Robert Frost, Kennedy, to deliver a poem at his inauguration. I don't remember. It probably was an original poem that Frost wrote for the inauguration. And I remember seeing Robert Frost's wonderful, old, creased, half-smiling, half-somber face with that beautiful voice he had, very distinctive voice. And there are recordings, by the way. You want to get them from the library or from some other place. There are recordings of Robert Frost. There's an album, in fact, of Robert Frost reading his poems floating around somewhere. And he reads his poems in exactly the way they should be read. They're beautiful. Anyhow, Robert Frost, so I was thinking Two Roads, Yellow Tree, Two Roads. So in my mind, it's going over and over again. The Road Less Traveled By, it turns out, of course. As I mentioned, it's called The Road Not Taken. And what is this poem about? It is really about somebody arriving at a certain point in the woods, and it was in the fall time, right? It was the yellow, you call it a yellow wood, which clearly means that the leaves were turning. And it was in the woods, and he comes to a fork, you know, two paths diverged. And one was clearly, he could see by looking at it, cleaned up, you know, it didn't have so many leaves or twigs, you know, cluttering up, hadn't fallen on it. It was much more used. There weren't that many leaves, and the leaves had been, the leaves that were there had been sort of trodden down by many, many muddy boots and feet, so that they were sort of blackish and kind of ground into the ground. And it was obviously much more traveled than the other road, which he looked at, this traveler in the woods being life, and the traveler being all of us. And you look over on the other side, and you see there's a path that's cluttered up. Maybe you have to, you know, beat your way through a couple of bushes to get to it. The leaves are still, you know, still golden color. Obviously, less traveled by people. And he took the road less traveled by. And here's the last stanza of that poem after he talks about that he, you know, went down the road less traveled by. He says, I shall be telling this with a sigh somewhere ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. And you see the genius of the man, you know, that he's talking about the most profound things in this clear, crystal clear way. But what he's saying here, what is he saying here? That he took the road less traveled by. And this is what I'm thinking about. That means he chose to take that one. He went down the rougher road. He went down the more difficult path. He took the road that most people don't take. And when you do that in life, when you take the road that's not the more traveled road, where there's going to be, first of all, if you take the road that's more traveled by, you're going to have more company. It will be a less lonely life. You take the road that's less traveled by, that people don't usually take, you're not going to run into people that much. You may not have a companion on the road that often, and you will be more lonely. You will be more isolated. More will be on you. You will have to do more to survive, you internally and externally. You take the road more traveled by, there'll be more help if you need it. But if you take the road more traveled by, one of the responsibilities you have, and this is part of making a choice, he took the road less traveled by. it involves responsibility. If you make a choice, it is incumbent upon you to be aware of what the choice is going to entail. What will happen? This is existence. This is pure existentialism. I don't know what I really don't know the history of Robert Frost. I don't know what Robert Frost's life was like. Clearly, there has to be a biography. Such a famous poet, such a great American figure, there must be biographies of Robert Frost. I don't know anything about the man's life. And I never heard him or anybody else, because I was drifting off in college, if anybody explained it, tell me what what his state of mind was. I never heard anybody interview Robert Frost or him say himself what he intended when he wrote this poem. But it seems pretty clear to me, and his poems are pretty clear, right? I don't think you have to ask the man what it means. And if you do have to ask him, then you didn't read the poem. So anyhow, he took the road less traveled by. And it reminded me of college. Because the first year I was in college, when I heard about Kennedy, I was a sophomore. But my first year in college, as a freshman, I had actually philosophy. They taught us philosophy, which is something I'm sure that they don't ever teach in school again, unless it's some Ivy League school, or unless you choose to be a philosophy major. I can't imagine them teaching philosophy in most other places. So history, philosophy, and poetry, out the window. Now it's all computer science and marketing and how to get rich or whatever, you know, business. Sports marketing, IT, tech, you know, whatever. But liberal arts, down the drain. People, they don't know. What can you get from studying liberal arts? You'll get a degree, which is actually, in fact, worth hardly anything. I mean, how many people do you know, including yourself, who have, you know, bachelor's degrees from college of almost any generation that it ever did you a whole lot of good? You know, in the 60s, when I graduated in 1966, when I got a bachelor's degree, it was essential to have a bachelor's degree to get certain jobs, and I guess maybe it still is. And I got a job in the civil service in New York City, but I had to have, as a welfare worker, I had to have a bachelor's degree to have this job. So, and from then on, I became the man I am today. But you had to have a bachelor's degree. I don't know what a bachelor's degree is worth these days, especially a bachelor's degree in liberal arts. It's probably utterly useless. It'll get you a job at McDonald's or maybe as a train conductor. I don't know, which are perfectly fine jobs, if you can't get any other job or if you want to work on trains, you know. But you're not going to get any really interesting or important job maybe with a bachelor's in liberal arts. And there aren't that many jobs to get. But when I was a freshman in college, which was in 1962, yeah, it's hard to believe, right? No, it's true. Yes, it's true. There were, in fact, in 1962, let me set the scene for you what 1962 was like. We used to play with baby dinosaurs. We played with baby dinosaurs, and also we had to crank cars to get them to work. There weren't, telephones had not yet been invented. And airplanes were also very new and all had propellers. So now you understand what it was like in 1962. Anyhow, it's a long time ago. And I took philosophy. The first thing they taught me in college was philosophy. I loved philosophy. I had never heard anything like this before. I grew up in a neighborhood which was a very sort of lower middle class, practical neighborhood. Most of my parents' generation, excluding my parents for other odd reasons, but most people in that neighborhood were not college graduates, had never even gone to college. They were mostly high school grads who were plumbers, plumbers' assistants, delivery men, cops, people like that. And philosophy? Yeah, here's I'll tell you the reigning philosophy in my neighborhood was, if you get into a fight, hit the other guy first. That was one. I'll tell you some of the philosophical principles of where I grew up, as taught to us by the men in the neighborhood and sometimes by the women. The women would teach us, like, make sure that, you know, you wash your hands and make sure you don't go to school dirty and make sure you have clean underwear. If you get hit by a car and, you know, you have like an autopsy, at least you'll have clean underwear. That was one philosophy. The other one was, don't do anything dangerous because you might hurt somebody or put your own eye out. Don't do that. Don't pick up a BB gun or use that. You'll put your eye out. If you're a man, this is what they would do. The men teach you. If you get into an argument with a guy, make sure you hit him first. Hit him in the mouth as hard as you can. Okay, I get it. That's true. That's a good philosophy. I think that's still a good philosophy, right? And what's the other philosophy? Do your homework. Study very hard. You shouldn't wind up, a loser and a bum. You know, and they all wanted, because most of the people in this neighborhood had lived through the Depression and, you know, World War II, never had a chance to go to college or never had the money, even if they, you know, could have done it. They wound up doing jobs that they didn't love, but, it made money and paid the bills. But they didn't, you know, it wasn't their dream job if they ever had one. And they all wanted us to go to college. And sure enough, you know, baby boomer generation I'm in, we all went to college, for better or for worse. So, but the first course I had in college one of the first courses was philosophy. And what they taught us was something I had never heard of before. And why would I ever heard of any philosophies growing up in that neighborhood? And especially in my house, too, where my mother's philosophy was, my mother was the only parent I had. Her philosophy was, I'm going to stay in my room because life is scary and don't bother me. And also, don't go outside the house because something might happen to you. That was her philosophy. Anyhow, so here I am studying philosophy, and I study William James. I'm studying this, that, and the other. And I come across, they teach us about something I had never heard of before called existentialism. Whoa, what's this? It's originally a French philosophy. I'm sure maybe there are other tributaries that contributed to it. But it was Jean-Paul Sartre, you know, and then Albert Camus, but especially Sartre. And the idea was that that life is nothing but choices all the time, that you have to always be making choices with other people. I mean, as simple as which direction you're walking in, or what you say, what the effect is of what you choose to say. It's all about choice. Existentialism is that if you make a choice, if there are two things and you choose one of them, you are saying yes to one thing, but you have to remember that you're saying no to something else. And this is a profound thing. And I had never heard about this before. Because you know how it is in life. Often you will choose to do something, or something seems more appealing to you. And without realizing it, or maybe on purpose, you reject some other choice. So let's say there are two girls that you're interested in, or if you're a girl, there's two guys you're interested in, and you sort of take up with one of them. What you have to understand, and the responsibility involved, is you are rejecting the other person. That was what was so fascinating to me about existentialism, that you had to be clear in your mind that you were always making choices, minor choices, sometimes had to do with language or direction that you walked in, and then, of course, big choices, you know, who you were with, what you chose to do with money, where you chose to, who you chose to hang out with. Did you want to actually help somebody named Frankie steal a car? Or did you want to not do that? Did you want to play stickball and take the chance that if the ball went into somebody's yard where they had a German Shepherd that would eat your head, did you want to take the chance of going over the fence to try to get your ball back because, you know, we didn't have any money? And if the ball was lost, that was the end of the game sometimes, right? So choices, everything was choices. I had never thought about this before because I grew up in a place, my house was different than the rest of the neighborhood where people had made lots of life choices, right? They maybe weren't happy with them, but they sort of tried to live with them or, you know, they accepted them. Sometimes they were bitter. But in my house, there was nobody making any choices. My father was gone forever. He was out of the picture, right? He chose to leave my house. He made an existential choice. And in choosing to do that, I doubt if he was aware of it. And most of us aren't. I'm not, you know, singling him out for blame. But most of us go through our lives choosing to do things and not being sufficiently aware, or sometimes aware at all, of what we have rejected and what the results are in terms of of the other people around us. What are the effects of other people around us when we choose to do something? If you want to leave a house where there's a wife and kids and go off and do something else, what is it that's going to happen to those wife and kids? My father decided to go off by himself and leave me to do, you know, to wander the world or whatever he chose to do. He chose to do this, right? He didn't want to be in this house anymore. He wasn't fit for this kind of family, and especially not for a wife. He didn't plan on his wife becoming insane, but literally insane, in and out of mental hospitals, incapable of functioning, not able to even do her job as a wife or a mother. He didn't count on that, to have a partner like that. And he didn't count on kids being so much trouble. Even when my mother was functional, up until the time I was about four, he wanted really nothing much to do with his children, especially me. It was very shortly after my sister was born that he took off. She hardly even knew him until later on. But so he has this little kid, and he had no idea about how to deal with me. You know, he was an old-fashioned guy brought up in the 30s and 40s, and he had certain attitudes about the way boys or men should be. And I was an oddball little kid. Had a lot of imagination. Things scared me. I would talk back and ask questions. It wasn't the kind of kid I think that he planned on. Although one thing, I was very athletic, so he liked that. Meanwhile, but I was kind of a sensitive, sort of fragile little kid in some ways, and he just couldn't stand that, because his philosophy was clear. He's the one who told me, if you get into an argument with a guy, punch him in the face first. Don't let him hit you first. Okay. So that's how my father grew up, who was kind of a tough guy. So my father made a choice. He chose to leave. I don't think that he understood what the effects would be on his children when he left them with a woman who was a raging maniac, right? And worse. But that's what he did. And like I say, that's old news. But I was fascinated by this idea of existentialism. That life is full of choices. I never understood choices. You know, we had to go to public school. There was no way around it, right? You were the truant officer, actually, once who came looking for me because I didn't go to school. We had truant officers. If you didn't go to school more than a couple of days, and if you were, sort of regularly avoiding school or not going, they would send out one of these people, work for the Board of Education, kind of sort of a cop, to check and see, half cop, half social worker, check and see why weren't you going to school? Had your parents actually killed you and stuffed you in the furnace downstairs? Had they sold you off, for a slave somewhere to Russia? Was something wrong in the family? Was there a problem? Why weren't you in school? And also, you had to be in school because that was the law. In New York City, I don't know about the rest of the state or the country, maybe it was New York State, you had to go until you were 16 years old, right? There was a time in the United States where you didn't have to go to school at all. Later on, in different places, there were different laws for different states or counties, probably states. 14, then 16, a lot of people just dropped out of school in the Depression and just went to work because they had to. They would have starved otherwise. But when I was growing up, it was still 16. You had to go to school till you were 16. Why? Because there was certain responsibility to the rest of society. They didn't want a whole country full of morons and idiots, people who had no idea how to read, how to write, how to add things up, how to subtract things, and how to operate simple machinery, or how to do anything, or how to behave socially in a classroom, how to sit and listen to people tell them things, how to follow orders. In other words, to be socialized and to learn the basics, right? If not more. So, clearly, obviously, they want you to stay in school till a certain point. And I was just thinking of RoboCop. Did you ever see RoboCop? RoboCop is this hysterical. I mean, it's a good movie, but it's this really funny movie where, I'm not going to do a whole long thing, but the hero, if you could call him that, of RoboCop, they take this man who is sort of barely alive, a policeman, and they turn him into a half, more than maybe a three-quarters of a robot. And he's a superhero. He has all kinds of powers to kill bad guys and villains. And he speaks like this because he's almost a robot. He has a sort of a voice, like a robot voice. And all little boys are jumping and girls are jumping up and down when he comes around because he's a big hero. And one of the reporters asks him in front of a bunch of little kids, like, RoboCop, they say, what do you think is the most important thing for little kids to do? And he says, stay in school. Stay in school, get a good job. That's what they used to tell us. Stay in school, get a good job. Which was true. It's true, right? The longer you stayed in school, it looked like, at least in those days, and it was true, that you would get a better job. No doubt about it. Anyhow, so, you know, we stayed in school till we were 16. But I don't know how I was going with this. But anyway, so anyhow, my father made this choice. My mother never made any choices. And this is because this whole thing I'm talking about here is about choosing, right? Because I took the one less traveled by. You see, the poem doesn't say, two roads diverged in a wood, and I sort of guessed that I would go down the one less traveled by. See, the poem doesn't say that. It doesn't say, two roads diverged in a wood, and I, because, you know, my wife thought it was a good idea. No, it says, I took the one less traveled by. Or it doesn't say, and then, you know, my mother wanted me to be a rabbi, so, or my father said, you know, I should be an engineer. And so I went down the other road, blah, blah, blah. No, I took the road. I chose to do this. I chose to take the road that was full of obstacles, difficulties, less traveled by, right? But back to the poem in a little while. But the idea, I learned existentialism in school. I was astounded and amazed and very impressed about this whole way of looking at life. And I thought this was really cool. And it was really real. That people should, I thought, and it made sense. Because when I was growing up, my father had chosen to go to disappear, and we suffered from his choice, not that he knew about it at all. My mother never made any choices, and if she did, they were negative, passive choices, and this is an important thing. If you don't choose at all, you're still choosing. If you are faced every day with how to treat your kids or how to treat your wife or your husband or your parents or your friends or how to act at work or how to act out in public or how to plot your life or what to do with your money or anything, if you choose to do nothing, it's still a choice. It's still a choice. A lot of people are under the impression that if they cover themselves up with the covers and stay in bed, or don't say anything in a situation, or don't respond if something is happening, or don't protest if something is happening that seems difficult or upsetting or dangerous or wrong. If you just stand by or retreat, that is as much a choice as being aggressive and taking the road less traveled by. If that man in those woods decided that it was too difficult to figure out which road to go down and decided he would do it tomorrow when he was in better shape and go home and have some popcorn and watch, football, that's a choice. Or if he decided to sit down right at the fork in the road and not move, that's also a choice. When you do nothing, you are choosing to do nothing. And what's the essential point throughout all this is that you are always choosing things, whether you know it or accept it or not. I know. I sound like a preacher or a teacher, right? But what can I do? It's not my choice. This is how I sound. So what can I tell you? But you are always choosing. And I was fascinated by this when I first heard it in, and they gave us, books to read, Sartre's, essays or whatever, and a book by Sartre, I forget. And then they gave us a couple of books by Albert Camus, which I thought were some of the worst books I ever read. They were so bleak and nasty. And there was one book by Camus, I think it's called L'Étranger. You know, I think I read it in French, too, because I took French. The Stranger. And they made a movie out of it with Jack Nicholson, which is actually not a bad movie if you want to, get lost in an existentialist bleak nightmare. And the idea, I hated this book, but the idea of The Stranger was, and they assigned this to us. We've got 5 minutes. So I can't choose to run over, can I? No? See now? Sometimes, and that's interesting, right? The engineer just told me I had 5 minutes to the show, and I asked him, can I choose to run over? And he says no, because it would run in to other things that he has to do, right? Or I could run into the next show. I can't do that, see? And so sometimes, obviously, life is not completely in your control. So within the context of what's in your control, then you can still choose. Or you can choose to go outside the framework of the life you're living and make other choices, live another life. For instance, if I'm told I can't run over here, I could just go out somewhere else and find a place maybe where I can run over, or maybe I could work hard, get some money, and get my own radio station. Pacifica Foundation is leasing WBAI to people who have a lot of money. You know, they're taking proposals now. See what I'm saying? It's not like if you live a life where everything is it seems as if it's not your choice. And that all depends on what? Racism, poverty, where you're born, what kind of family you're born into, what's expected of you in certain societies, religious restrictions. Imagine, you know, all the things. Like if you're drafted during Vietnam, when people were drafted, they could choose to go to Canada and pay the price for it. Or they could choose to work as hard as they could to get out of the draft. You know, go down to the draft board with a letter from a doctor saying that your back didn't have four vertebrae in it, or you were insane, or whatever. People are always making choices. And what people don't realize is that they're making choices. You know, this book, The Stranger, was just horrible. It was so bleak and boring. And I think the point of it was, now that I look back on it, that the reason it was bleak and boring was because the hero did not make choices. He allowed life to push him along. And all my life, or I should say most of my life, and I have been suitably petty and bitter about it, I have not taken responsibility. Many times I was in situations with people, families. I've been married 3 times. Not once did I choose, really, to get married. Right? I have 2 kids. Did I really choose to have 2 kids? No, not really. It was something somebody else wanted. I have done so much in my life that other people wanted me to do. I had once had a lot of money and was kind of talked into doing certain things with it and lost it all. I had certain very, very successful, even possibly wildly successful career choices to me open sometimes, but I chose, though I didn't know it at the time, to screw them up by being self-destructive. I made some very bad choices that anybody in their right mind or common sense who wasn't self-destructive wouldn't have made. But the point is that you're always making a choice. You are always making a choice. You're on the road, to use that metaphor, and to use Mr. Frost's metaphor. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. And I was thinking to myself, here I am on the radio doing something that maybe nobody else does on the radio. And I've been doing this for 35 years. In fact, as far as I can tell, I don't think anybody else in the United States does what I do on the radio. And there was a time, once or twice in my life, that people were impressed by this, and certain people with money and power and the ability to make a big star out of me, for instance, and said, this is really quite something, and tried to help me make something out of it, and I screwed it up. And I'm thinking to myself, and this is the way people are. Most of our lives, we spend learning this. Most people in this country, especially the country as a whole, the United States, is one of the most unaware, stupid, irresponsible countries that has ever lived. We go all over the world invading countries, landing troops in places, making choices. Constantly, people who are in power in this country make choices, and the country itself seems to go along with it, or the country makes choices to do things, which result in tremendous misery for the rest of the world, and we don't pay attention or we don't know it. The deal here with this poem and with your life and with everything else is, whatever you do, there's always a choice going on. You may not know it, but you should know it. And you may not be conscious of the effects on other people, but you should be. But you should be. You know, when you take a vote, when you pick up a gun, when you say, I'm leaving the home, when you say, I've had an affair, when you say to a kid, I don't care what you're doing, when you hit somebody, when you insult somebody, when you do anything like that, you are making a choice. You may think you had no choice. You always have some modicum of a choice. So, you know, I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. If you walk down the rough road, then you're going to have a rough life, but you should accept that and pay the price for it. That's what it's all about. I know, because I haven't done that very well, but I know that I need to do it. Thank you.
And then I have to pack my things and go. Better understand.